Hi, this is Neil Monins from WineRelease.com. I'm here with Nick Gramkowski, and we're talking about the reader opinion survey that I did on WineRelease.com, making enhancement methods. So I'm here with Nick Gramkowski, and he's got a lot of experience in blending wines for retailers and restaurants. So Nick, can you give first a little background of what you do currently, and then how you know so much about blending wines?
Neil, well, thank you for having me. My job primarily is as an importer of premium wines from Argentina and sake from Japan. My company is Vine Connections, but I also have done for many years custom blending for both distributors, restaurants, and retailers throughout the U.S. And it's just common practice that in the industry, there are ways to make wines more consumer-friendly. In Neil's WineRelease.com reader opinion survey, he tried to cover some of the main ways that that winemakers attack the area of consumer-friendly wines.
And the first question, we start out with an easy question that I asked the consumers. I wanted to throw out a softball question to them of oak barrels. You know, which are obviously everybody knows are used to store the wine during aging, and it adds a vanilla toastiness, tannins, and creaminess to the wine. And when you think about it, that is manipulating the wine because you're taking the wine grapes, instead of putting in stainless steel or plastic, you're putting in this oak, which is very traditional, but it does enhance those flavors, tannins, and other things to the wine, rounds them out the flavors. So it's no surprise here that 91% of the trade said, yes, okay, you don't need to disclose that on the label. 57% of the consumers said, okay, no need to disclose on the label. 43% of the consumers said, okay, but it should be disclosed on the label. But if you look at overall, 100% of the consumers and 98% of the trade, they all agreed, yes, okay, this is an okay practice. When we get down to other things such as oak staves, when the trip we took down to Argentina and Chile, that was the first time that I ever saw oak staves being used, where I looked inside of a huge stainless steel and there were oak staves stacked all the way up to the top. And that's when I asked you about that, and then you clued me in on what that's for. Saves a lot of money.
The practice of using oak is paramount to quality winemaking. You can't have quality wines without using some form of oak, meaning that oak barrels are dynamic and not static. It allows for the exchange of oxygen, so the wine gets a chance to expand, soften, develop more aromatics, more flavor profiles. You can make great wine in stainless steel as well, but it's a different style of wine. And the consumer, in general, seems to appreciate wines that spend time in oak. But oak barrels today are very, very expensive, especially with the exchange rate currently against the euro. The practice of using oak staves and oak chips has become more prevalent in the industry. You can make very good wines from using oak staves, but in general, you use that for wines that would retail for $20 and under. Same with oak chips, maybe more for wines that are going to retail for $10 and under. And then expensive French oak barrels, and now quality oak barrels are being produced from American wood here in the U.S. at lower prices than the imported counterparts. So, but oak in general is a primary component in quality winemaking.
So we go down to question four of sugar and adding chapelize, which is legal in Europe, not legal here. First, quickly tell us why, and then if you are surprised at these results.
Well, I am a little bit surprised at the results. Chaptalization is a practice that's used in Europe because they don't get the alcohol levels high enough given different vintages. And so
weather conditions primarily?
Well, the weather conditions are what drives that, is that you don't get enough sun time, so that your Brix level, which is the measure of sugar in the grape, is not high enough, it's not elevated enough. So the government has allowed the addition of sugar in order to elevate the alcohol levels to give the wines a little bit more body, a little more texture. In the U.S., it's primarily here in California, we have plenty of sunshine. And so chaptalization should not be needed. But the consumer has driven the fact that they like bigger, more powerful wines. So sometimes wineries will pick grapes a little bit more balanced level of Brix and then add sugar in order to increase alcohol levels. But also there are years due to weather here that we don't get high enough alcohol levels, so people, you do see sugar being brought into wineries for the purpose of chaptalization. What I find interesting is that 73% of the trade felt it was okay to chaptalize, when in general they should not have that as a tool at their disposal. The use of sugar does take place, but it's not a legal option.
It's legal to add unfermented concentrated grape juice. I remember we had that in our refrigerator when you were doing blends. But the purpose of that wasn't to increase alcohol. The purpose was actually to add sweetness to the wine.
Add a level of sweetness and texture, correct.
Okay. So chaptalizing is illegal to if you intend to increase the alcohol level in the wine.
Well, that's the definition of chaptalization.
Okay.
Correct.
So what percent of wine in the United States is this being done, do you think?
Well, I mean, in California, it's a factor of weather. I would say that you'd find chaptalization happening more in Oregon, New York, sort of long in the Finger Lakes district, as well as Long Island, where you have Michigan, northern Michigan, up in Traverse City. California, it does not happen very often, as it would in other parts of the country.
Is it really frowned upon, or is it kind of accepted? But just...
it's accepted. No winemaker would frown upon another winemaker because of it. They may not agree with it, but they know that it's part of life.
Yeah. So. 'Cause I remember I was on a tour up in Napa one time. Tour guide said, yes, this one who named a vintage, I forget what the vintage was, it was really, they needed to add sugar. And he said, yeah, if you're walking past your fermentation tank with a 25-pound bag of sugar on your way to put it in your coffee and it happened to fall in the fermentation tank, it's not like you're going to throw that wine away. So that was their way of saying, yes, it does.
That's
happen.
Correct. You have to realize this is a once-a-year product. You get one chance at each fermentation tank, and that's it. And so if your livelihood is dependent upon that tank, you do what you need to do in order to maximize the quality of the wine. You can't just say, oh, well, I'll get it next week. You don't get another chance.
And then how common, since it is legal in Europe, how common is it? Is it every vintage?
It's every vintage.
Sugar, you add sugar, you just have to determine how much?
Right. Every vintage, people are chaptalizing for sure.
Has it happened more often with certain wines, Cabernets and Syrahs, your Reds versus your Chardonnays and your Sauvignon Blancs?
Yeah, it happens with wines that people expect to have a little bit more alcohol levels to them. So a little bit more body, a little bit more power. Anywhere throughout Europe, it can happen. But places like Spain, Portugal, where you have plenty of sun, lots of heat, there's really no reason to... It's more the northern European appellations of Italy, France, Germany, places like that.
So after sugar, we have acid. So acid, everyone is around the world is allowed to add acid, correct?
Correct. Acid adjustments are done to balance the wines. So even in places that have natural high acidities, if you go through malolactic fermentation, which is conversion of malic acid, your green pippin apple acid, to lactic acid, which is your milk acid, you then might need to do some acid adjustments in order to have a little bit better balance in your wines. So you can do that at any point.
And here the question is pretty close in terms of the total of the okays. It's 88% of the consumer, 97% of the trade. Even questions 1 through 5, most of the trade is okay, don't need to disclose it on the labels. And a lot of verbatims I got from a lot of winery people, they did point out that there's not a whole lot of room on these labels to put these different things. Why do you think the consumer wants to know if the wine has been altered or not?
I think it's a good question, Neil. I think the consumer in general is more afraid than... wine starts out as grapes. We can eat grapes as we do table grapes, and you can eat wine grapes. And so the idea of any sort of manipulation sounds horrific or draconian, maybe, that somehow people are doing something that is unhealthy and they could somehow have an ill effect because of it. But I think that these questions, they're good questions. They're questions to educate the consumer with, but to put them as a mandatory on a label would just fill up the label with a bunch of information that the consumer really does not understand. And there's no room to explain why you do something, why you add acid, why you would chaptalize, why you use oak barrels. So I think that, you know, there are certain questions here that where the consumer and the trade differs more, but I think in questions 1 through 5, which are very common practices and meant to actually help the wine, if you have a bad harvest because of weather, you need to have a certain alcohol level in order to have a quality wine. As I stated earlier, for a winemaker and for a winery, they only get one harvest, and so it's important for them to be able to address those issues. And because chaptalization in the U.S. or in California is not legal, just because it's not legal, if we do have a very cool harvest period, do you want the winemakers to not be able to earn a living because someone put that in writing in law somewhere? Winemakers look at it and say, well, we don't chaptalize if we don't have to, but if we have to, then we should do it. So they're drinking a lot of coffee and spilling a lot of sugar. And I think that adding acid, doing acid adjustments, again, that's a function of trying to have a balanced wine. I think where we get more interesting is in the latter questions, which are deal more with ways for winemakers to perform some tricks of the trade in order to sex up their wines a little bit, to make them more flashy, more appealing to the consumer, differentiate themselves from their neighbors who may not be using those tricks. And I think that's more interesting.
Yeah, definitely number 6, I added that question because of the movie Mondo Vino, the micro-oxygenation. So that's the controlled introduction of oxygen into wine to soften the tannins. So first explain, is this a machine? What is this?
Micro-ox was something that was first founded in an appellation in the south of France, in the southwest of France, called Matiron. And in Matiron, you have a grape variety called Tannat. And the way to remember Tannat is that Tannat equals tannin. It's a very tannic grape, also commonly found in Cahors. What happened is someone came up with the idea that introducing micro bubbles of oxygen during fermentation in the fermenter helps break down short chain tannins to long chain tannins, meaning you get softer, rounder tannins, making the wines more approachable, especially at early age, but also gives the wines an opportunity to age a little bit more quickly to make the wines more user-friendly. What has been discovered is that even in places like California where you get pretty ripe tannins, but yet what happens here often is that we get Indian summers in September, and so you get a spike in sugar levels pretty quickly. And what that means is that you don't get the physiological ripeness of the fruit in balance with the tannins. So sugar levels go up and the tannins stay green. They're not brown yet. They haven't had enough hang time. So Californians have discovered, well, using micro-ox here helps do the same thing. You get these high levels of sugar, you pick because you can't wait for physiological ripeness, and then you can use something like micro-ox. It's a good tool for people who need it. It's not anything that is harmful. It just is a slow introduction of oxygen into the fermenter during fermentation.
Does this happen over minutes, hours, days?
Over days. So
it's just a stainless steel tube that goes in, or...?
It's just it's not a tube. They actually, in the bottom of the tank, will have a place for you to hook up your oxygen, and you have a valve, and you can slowly introduce the oxygen that way. So it's micro, it's small, meaning mini. So it's a very slow introduction during fermentation.
Next question on color, adding dyes to enhance the color of the wine. Here is where we start getting some differences in terms of the consumer versus the trade.
Well, adding color, mega purple is a very common component to be that's used in making wines darker. People see dark wine, they feel it's richer, Therefore, it's more flavorful versus a lighter looking wine. If you sit down and do consumers love to have parties where they do tasting parties, and you have seven wines in seven wine glasses, and people look at the color, and we're predisposed, then the darker wines are going to be more interesting, more flavorful. Oftentimes, the lighter colored wines are overlooked for flavor. They have plenty of flavor and be more flavorful, even though you're lighter in color. So a lot of wineries, because it's driven by the consumer's desire for darker wines, will use Mega Purple to help with that.
Primarily reds, obviously.
Yes, and reds. Whites.
Pinot versus Cab.
People are making Pinot Noirs today as if they were making Zinfandel and Cabernet. High alcohol, not very elegant and subtle and refined, but explosive 15% plus alcohol levels in Pinot Noir, which is, I think, very consumer driven, not quality winemaking driven.
What percent of the wines out there do you think are touched with color?
It's a difficult answer because
legal, correct?
It is legal. You have no idea who's doing it or not doing it and where they're getting their color or not getting their color. I don't want to venture a guess because I think it's probably pretty high that it's being used on some level in many wineries. So.
And then back to the micro ox, what percent do you think of the wineries or the wines out there?
I think that's still probably a pretty small percentage of wineries.
It's so new.
It's newer technology. It's technology you need to invest in. You need to be committed to using it. So I think it's a smaller percentage.
Next question, alcohol. So that's added to alter the taste, texture, and structure of the wine itself. It's probably our biggest swing yet. So 50% of the consumers say it's okay. 71% of the trade say it's okay. So first, is this legal, and when is it being done?
Well, I mean, the addition of alcohol, you can't use grain alcohol. In general, I think this goes with the chaptalization question. You're looking for bigger alcohol, so if you need to, you would add sugar. Often what's happening, and this goes to question number 9, is wineries are allowing their grapes to hang longer. You get higher Brix levels. With the higher Brix levels, you get higher alcohols, and then you figure out how to actually pull it back to what's called a sweet spot. Touching on question 9 at the same time, what happens is that with the sweet spot, a winery will line up their wines, go through cone reverse osmosis, and remove alcohol levels at different varying degrees until they get to a spot where they feel the wine tastes the best.
When you say sweet spot, is this a percentage you're talking about?
No. Okay. It's just a sweet spot for that particular wine. Sweet spot meaning not sweet as in sugar, but sweet as in tasty. Let's say that the wine was picked at a Brix that gives you 15.5% alcohol, and then they do something back to 14.5% alcohol, and they go, wow, that's the best tasting wine on the table. So they might have a full range that goes from 15.5 all the way down to 13.5, and they might do it in 0.5% decreases or 0.25% decreases. And then they taste them all, and the wine that they feel tastes the best, the most balanced, is the wine that is what they do. And they'll de-alcoholize the wine to get to that level.
And how prevalent is that?
Again, it's an investment, so it's not widely used. It is used. It's not. I wouldn't say it's every winery, but I think that a lot of the great wines being made here in California at some point probably have gone through this process.
Question 10, water. Here was a huge difference. So 60% the consumers say yes, it's okay. 86% of the trade say yes, it's okay.
Where water comes into play here in California is that you have, with high alcohol levels, you also have the inability for some fermenters to complete fermentation. You get what's called stuck fermentation. The yeast just can't survive in the environment that they're in. Because of that, in order to reduce that problem, you add water to reduce the alcohol level to give a better environment for the yeast to survive, continue with fermentation, so that you finish. It's a pretty wide method here in California.
And in terms of white versus red, is there any difference on these?
More for in reds. In whites, you're not looking for that same sort of extraction of body and tannin and power. You know, your Cabernets, your Syrah, your Zins are much bigger in body than you're looking for Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay or Riesling, Chenin Blanc or anything like that.
Question 11 with tannins.
The addition of tannic acid, again, goes back to previous question of acidifying and so forth. I mean, if you have a wine that is a little bit low in structure and you want a little bit more structure to the wine, you can add tannic acid. From a winemaking standpoint, again, it's about increasing quality. I think it's, you know, the more important questions as far as tricks of the trade are 7, combination of 8, 9, and 10, where, you know, these are practices not used by everybody, but they can be something that really alters the wine considerably.
And then tannic acid, does that happen to all reds?
Well, it would happen every year, but not to all reds. It happens, you know, it's a case-by-case basis on, it could happen in a winery for one wine, but not for another wine. Because it all depends on the structure that they're looking for, and if they have, you know, whether they have achieved that naturally or not. If they haven't, then they're going to do something about it.
Question 12, that was an easy one. The fine filtering, 98% of consumers say yes, it's fine. 96% of the trade actually said fine. One thing about fining and filtering, remember, again, that you fine and filter out and cold stabilize wines sometimes so the consumer doesn't get those, you know, glass shards, which are actually tartaric acid.
Right.
So why don't you talk about cold stabilization, and actually then we'll touch on fine and filtering.
Cold stabilizing a wine is a way of preventing snowflakes from appearing in your wine. And what happens if you don't cold stabilize is that you'll get the formation of tartaric crystals that are floating to the bottom and people find very unsightly and appealing. There's no flavor alteration. The wine is not harmed. It's more something that you do in order to protect yourself commercially.
But with cold stabilizing the wine, there is the argument that you are taking out some of the flavors. That's why certain winemakers would rather cold stabilize their wine to a higher temperature level than other winemakers that have more product out there in the marketplace.
In cold stabilizing the wine, that doesn't remove flavors, no. There's argument that fining could strip some flavor profile from the wine, but more filtering. I mean, in Europe, for example, most wines go through 2 winters, so they naturally get cold stabilized before they're bottled. So they get a natural cold stabilization in the cellar. You can check for that, you know, in the lab as well. You know, here, winters are not as cold as they are in Europe, but up in Oregon they are, they're cold. In the cellar, you can have natural cold stabilization take place. On whites, because you tend to only go through 1 winter, and depending on where you are, it's not cold enough, you would actually put the wine into a tank and reduce the temperature and cold stabilize the wine in the tank. It doesn't remove flavor to do that. When you fine a wine using egg whites, gelatin, and essentially what you're doing is creating sort of a magnet in the wine with albumin. And what that does is it sort of floats around the wine, collects all these particles, and then will get heavy and settle to the bottom. And then you will rack off the wine from there, meaning that you'll remove the wine in the barrel to another barrel or to a tank if you want, and then leaving the egg whites behind. And so that clarifies the wine. Filtering the wine, there are different ways of filtering and different levels of filtering, and there are definitely arguments that people will make that you're stripping the wine of flavor components and so forth. If you're making a small amount of wine, you have more control over it, and you feel more comfortable about the wine, you can bottle a wine that's unfined and unfiltered, because you can naturally clarify a wine by racking. But you have to be careful about that because of the introduction of oxygen. Every time you rack, you're removing the wine and going through an oxygenative process. You have to be careful about how much oxygen you want to introduce to your wine. And then filtering, you don't have to filter either. But it all depends. If you're making 100,000 cases, you have less control over each individual tank as you do if you're making 1,000 cases. So it's based on, I think, the consumer confidence and tolerance for what's in their wine. And so therefore, from a commercial standpoint, the winery will make that determination based on their size and control and things like that.
I think from the consumer standpoint, too, consumers have to realize that if they have that wine in lying in their cellar on the side and then they're going to go to drink it, that they shouldn't just take it out of the cellar, especially if it's an older bottle of red, and then just drink it, but they should plan to have it sit upright for a week or two before drinking, which is a lot of times it's tough to do when after you're on your third bottle of wine at your dinner party. Having yourself prepared makes a lot more enjoyable experience.
You know, that's for very serious wines, but for just sort of your $20 and under retail wines, you want to, you know, the consumer wants something that's clear and clean and not cloudy, doesn't have tartaric crystals floating around. They want to have a pure product in their, or what they consider pure. There are those who consider what's pure is that which is touched the least or handled the least. But like I said, it all comes down to the commercial side of your size and what you feel your consumer will tolerate. So there are people who are proud of their wines being unfined and unfiltered and promote that. And so the consumer is aware of what's happening. It's on the label. And so if they do buy a wine that says unfined and unfiltered and they see something that they don't like, it's explained to them why that's the case.
Okay, last question on glycerol. It's really close in terms of consumer and trade acceptance, with 61% and the consumers and 63% of the trades agreeing that it's okay. So the only other one that was even close to this was the color question. So this was kind of like the second most controversial. Can you talk about that? Because isn't it, adding glycerol is illegal, correct?
Correct. What glycerol does is add texture and softness and and so you can get wines that have these really huge structural components to them, and then you can add glycerol, which will help round that out. Again, finding that sweet spot. You can measure your levels of glycerol, and you can do different trials and find out at what level the wine tastes the best and bottle from there. It's not natural winemaking, in the sense that you're really scientifically looking at trying to manipulate the flavor profile, the structural profile, and impression of the wine. Lots of winemakers do it because they can make really sexy wine that way. And they can push the envelopes of alcohol and ripeness, structure, and then, you know, use this sort of final dash of salt to make a great dish, a great wine.
Now, what is glycerol used for? So why is it available? Where is it legally used?
I'm sure it's used in a lot of commercial products that you want texture with, but I don't know that, the answer, really. Never used it.
And then how prevalent do you think glycerol is?
I think prevalent in wines of higher profile.
And then what percent or how much glycerol do you add to a wine? Is this parts per million? Is it a teaspoon for every gallon?
No, it's very small amount, anywhere from 8 to 15 to 20 grams per liter.
So overall, looking at all the answers, what surprised you most?
The chaptalization question that in the trade respondents, that 3/4 of the people who responded felt it was okay, because that's something that, in general, they shouldn't really have to play with too much. But I think when you look at it, I think their answer is okay, because they are looking at it from their livelihood, that if they have to use chaptalization, they will, and it should be okay, because it permits them to continue making wine that vintage.
Who regulates this? Is this the BATF?
It was the TTB, yeah.
And do you think there's a chance that they would allow this to happen, to chaptalize the wines in the future?
I haven't heard any talk about trying to change that, no.
Do you think their winemakers don't want to come out and say that because they don't want to admit they're doing it? You don't want to be the lead the charge to say, yes, I want to manipulate my wine?
Well, but in chaptalization, I think in general in California, they don't need to do it. So I think the argument, again, would be that it was a bad harvest, and if they don't do it, their wines are not going to be commercially viable, and so they should be allowed to do it. So I don't think it's a negative to be able to do that. I think that it was interesting to see that on the color question, that on the trade side, it was pretty much split 50-50 between not being allowed to be used and being allowed to be used. I thought that was interesting. There is artistry involved in making wine, and you're going to have people who want to try and stay as close to the purity of the product, but will be often at a disadvantage by those who are trying to just make the most souped-up car possible. So I think that was interesting to see. What I thought was really interesting was the question number 9, the de-alcoholization, that the trade felt that there was no problem with that being used. With the yeast strains that are being used today, hang time of getting higher Brix levels, it's just a way for them to make bigger, more extracted wines and then not be penalized for that because they can use this technology. So same with water, that goes to number 9. You have big water, you need to finish your fermentation. Do you add some water to help cut that back? So I thought those two were really interesting. The trade seems to be very much on the stance that it's okay to do what they need to do. Glycerol was pretty much viewed by the trade as being okay as well, and finding the sweet spot in wines.
Okay, overall, what wines do you think are manipulated the most?
Red wines are definitely manipulated the most from a consumer standpoint. Of trying to make big extracted wine. There's definitely things you do in white wines as well, but you're not looking for the same extraction of power from white wines as you are from red wines.
Of the red wines, how many of these different manipulations would be common in one single wine?
I think that chaptalization would be the least that's happening. Microrocks is certainly happening at a lot of levels for high-end wines. The addition of color can be baited because depending on your vineyard sources, what varietals you're talking about, the level of hang time, the level of yield, you may or may not have to use color. De-alcoholization is happening more and more. The addition of glycerol is happening more and more. And I think you certainly could easily see a wine being micro-oxed with de-alcoholization and glycerol and all in the same wine, for sure.
And then in your just general opinion, so you could, let's say you buy wine off the bulk market from somebody who has wine that just wouldn't fit with their portfolio one year. You take that wine as the base, and then you do all these different manipulations to it. How much of a difference can you make? And also even in terms of a score, you're going from a wine that's 86, you're going to a 92, or are you going to 86 to an 89?
I think you can make a huge difference from a commercialization standpoint. You can take a wine that has very little body and very little flavor profile and make it palatable enough to be sexy for a short period of time. Are you going to make a great wine? No. But you can make a very good wine out of an average wine in the short term.
In the short term, we're talking how many years?
A year to 2 years.
Before some of these things start to
fall off? Until the wine starts to fall off.
What are some of the biggest changes here that are the riskiest to do for the long haul?
If you're making very good wine to begin with, and then you're using some of these techniques of de-alcoholization, glycerol additions, water, the wines could be great for a long time, but if you are doing things like color addition, glycerol additions to wines that are weak to begin with, then those wines don't have a long life. It all depends on the intent of the wine to begin with, as far as longevity. To de-alk a wine, to add water, add glycerol, is not necessarily going to create a hugely, much shorter lifespan. Because what might happen is if you didn't do any of these, the wine might have huge tannin profile, but in the end, the fruit will die off before the tannins do. And so you didn't have a long life anyways. Trying to get a more balanced wine, even through some of these techniques, if you get a more balanced wine, you might have a longer living wine.
So I was at the luncheon the other day with a winery owner talking about this survey, and his response was, so-and-so does it, we don't do any of this. So I imagine talking to a lot of wine people, they're going to say that they don't do it. What percent are telling the truth? What percent are doing some manipulation?
I think that everyone probably does something along at some point. Everyone wants to talk about how they don't do this or they don't do that. The fact of the matter is, if you want to be competitive, it's just like testosterone. I mean, it's hard to watch someone hit the ball out of the park and you know they're juiced up, and you have a choice to try and compete without juicing up or to juice up and be on a more level playing field. If you see your neighbors getting high scores on a consistent basis and now their wines are jumping up in price and they're selling out every year and you are not getting the high scores and your wines take longer to sell, it's a difficult process to watch and not fall victim to. And I think that everybody on some level is trying to make their wines as appealing to the consumer and the press, more importantly, as possible, and will do what they need to do to achieve that.
Now, in terms of manipulation, countries that are manipulating their wines more than others?
No, I think all countries now. I mean, the great thing about technology, and which includes the internet, where you have dissemination of information, you have a lot more trade seminars, conferences taking place around the world than ever before. So people are sharing techniques and secrets, and not secrets in a bad sense, but ways for them to achieve better practices in the vineyard and better practices in the winery. And people are learning what they need to do to be competitive with the world market. And you go into a lot of wineries these days and you see lots of different types of machines, and they're there to help make better quality wine. It all depends on how much of a purist you are and what you think a winemaker should be allowed to do or not to do. And that's a difficult question, because a lot of the wines that people are paying lots of money for are being manipulated on some level. Obviously, that means that the press and the consumer is appreciating that. You look at Bordeaux today, and Bordeaux wines are much more accessible early in their life than ever before. Sure, we've had some warmer vintages in Bordeaux, but also it's technology available to winemakers that are making this possible. So
that's micro-ox.
There's other things, Delestage, micro-ox, all these things that allow tannins and oxygen to be introduced to the wine in a more controlled environment that makes the wines more appealing earlier. Is it wrong? I don't know. If the wines are better than ever before, then maybe it's hard to say it's wrong. It's just different. It's different skills. It's different opportunities. And the consumer obviously is enjoying the wines more because the wine's never been more expensive than they are today. That is really the bottom line, is supply and demand. And if demand is increasing because people are enjoying wine more, then maybe there's nothing wrong with it.
Okay, I think, Nick, that's it. I really appreciate spending some time here. Anybody could find the details of this survey at www.winerelease.com, and under the other section, there'll be the posting of this survey results, full results.
Neil, thank you for having me, and I think it's always good to question what's happening and for the consumer to be aware when they're drinking a bottle of wine that it's not just grape juice, but there's more going on inside that bottle than they may be aware of.